Okay, this is your kind of little revision test. Who can remember what John was talking about last week? This is worrying, John. Can you remember what you were talking about last week? can anyone remember what John was talking about last week? This isn't a good sign. This is not a good sign. It was the leper. Thank you, Rachel. At least one, John, one person was listening to you, mate. That's good, isn't it, really? That's not bad. yeah, we're in Matthew 8. The context is it's a section of Matthew's gospel that follows on immediately after the Sermon on the Mount. To all appearances, what seems to have happened is that Jesus has come down from the mountain. And the encounter with the leper seems to have taken place kind of on the way back down. And the passage that we're going to look at follows on from that when he has reached kind of his base camp in Galilee, which is Capernaum, the place where Peter's family home was and where most of Jesus' Galilean ministry is based from. And so it's continuing that journey down the mountain. And it's another encounter that takes place after the Sermon on the Mount. But this time it takes place in the town of Capernaum. So let me just read to you the passage. It's Matthew 8. It's starting to read at verse 5. Verse 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering." Jesus said to him, "I will go and heal him." The centurion replied, "Lord, I don't deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one go and he goes, and that one come and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, "I tell you the truth, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you, many will come from the east and the west and take their place at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness. Will there be weeping and gnashing of teeth?" And then Jesus said to the centurion, "Go, it will be done just as you have believed it would." And the servant was healed at that very hour. I'm aware this is an incredibly familiar passage. It's the sort of stuff that you've probably kind of known from Sunday school. What struck me was that when I read it, there were kind of pennies that dropped to me for the first time that I just kind of had missed before. And if you kind of think, "Oh, Chris, had you not seen that before?" And, you know, please forgive me, but I was quite excited by that. It seems to me that there's a fascinating connection between the passage that John spoke on that Rachel could remember, the healing of the leper, and this passage. There are a couple of things that kind of come out that are in common, really. And I just thought that was an interesting starting point for what I wanted to say tonight. You will be aware that all of the Gospels have a slightly different flavour. You know, Matthew, Mark and Luke kind of follow the same kind of pattern. John has a distinctly different pattern and he kind of approaches things from a slightly different way. But also, even within Matthew, Mark, and Luke, kind of, they are written with different purposes in mind. Luke is a Gentile, and he writes to a Gentile audience, a non-Jewish audience. Matthew is much more writing for Jewish hearers. And you get a bit of a sense of that in both the healing of the leper and also in this encounter with the centurion. Because actually there are things that have come out that have kind of more meaning for a Jewish person than they might have for us. but they just open an interesting perspective, it seems to me. So, for example, in the healing of the leper, when Jesus has healed him, Jesus also asked the leper to go and report to the priest. So Jesus is kind of not just healing the man, but he's also concerned with kind of fulfilling the Jewish law of what should happen in the law when a leper is healed. And that's something that Matthew writes down because he's writing for a Jewish audience. He would want them to kind of see how Jesus' actions tie in with what was kind of demanded by the law. And there's a little bit of a twist on this here, because kind of there's this whole debate that goes on between the centurion and Jesus. And, you know, should Jesus go to the centurion's house? And the centurion saying no. And actually that's fascinating, because a Jewish person shouldn't enter into a Gentile's home. So there's that little nuance on this that kind of Matthew kind of is picking up on, that these are things that kind of would make sense to Jews, but just might pass us by. And I know that that's kind of just a bit of a strange thing to highlight to begin with, but it made me see something afresh that I just hadn't seen before. Because both of the Jewish rules that Matthew is just kind of picking up on, the business that the leper had to go and report to a priest, the way that Jesus shouldn't enter the house of a Gentile, although it seems to me, if you kind of get the feeling of it, actually Jesus didn't give a toss for the Jewish rules. The person mattered more than the rules, and Jesus was more than happy to go there. It's just the centurion that realizes it's not the done deal and you shouldn't do it. It seems to highlight something that actually both passages have in common, that the people that Jesus is dealing with are both outsiders. The leper is the obvious outsider. You know, part of being a leper, as John said last week, was that actually you can no longer be part of the community. You're excluded from the community because you're regarded as being unclean. So you live outside the community. You might live with other lepers, but you're outside. The reason you had to go to the priest afterwards is you needed the priest's approval that you're really clean to be part of the community again. You're an outsider. And kind of, we often kind of, you know, kind of, we're aware that there are modern day lepers. When the whole AIDS crisis started up, there was something akin to leprosy, because people were scared of lepers. And people were really scared of anyone that might have HIV. They were frightened that by going anywhere near them, they might catch it. And kind of people treated people that had HIV as being subhuman almost. They kind of treated them in a way that was appalling to begin with, when kind of that whole kind of thing hit the headlines. And it was almost like a kind of a modern version of leprosy. Kind of, there are other people that kind of are almost outsiders in society, not because they have a disease like leprosy, but because they live on the outside of society. You know, I don't know how you find yourself kind of feeling with homeless people. You know, some people can find it really easy to go up to someone that's homeless, give them some food, but actually sometimes homeless people can be jolly threatening. You know, you're going in and out of the car park in Monson Row, and actually, you know, there's just something that, you know, makes you recoil. And, you know, perhaps that's revealing my own sensibilities. And there's a sense that actually that they are living on the outside of society. And there's something akin to that whole thing about leprosy. And we can think about people being, you know, the outsiders when they are on the obvious outside of society. When their lives are broken, when their lives are messed up, when they've got a disease that they're struggling with. We can see it in that sort of way. But actually, the centurion is just as much an outsider. Jesus couldn't go to his house because he's a Gentile. The centurion has wealth and he has privilege, but he's still an outsider. He's a Gentile in a Jewish community. He can't go into the home of a Jewish person and share a meal. A Jewish person will not come into his home. And I just found it quite fascinating that there is this kind of common thread between these two stories, that in both occasions, Jesus is dealing with outsiders. And I actually find the whole thing about the centurion all the more provoking for that reason. Because, you know, here's someone that's got wealth and power and influence, and yet they're still on the outside. And we kind of are quite good at thinking about homeless people as being outsiders, or people that have HIV, or people that kind of don't fit into society. And actually, kind of being an outsider isn't about where we are in society. It's not about the have-nots. It can just as much be about those that have. And actually, and often it can come from something that's within us that makes us feel like we don't belong. You know, you don't have to have little to have that sense of not belonging. You can have much and still feel yourself excluded and on the outside. And that's the case with this man in this story. So let's pick up on the story. Jesus has returned to Capernaum, as I said. I went to Israel a couple of years ago. Probably my favourite place I went to while I was there was Capernaum. And that's partly because when you go to Capernaum, it is pretty much as it would have been at Jesus' time. Capernaum ceased to be occupied at about 1100 AD. What that means is, well, if you go to Jerusalem, kind of it's been continuously occupied since the time of Christ. So wherever Jesus walked is probably 20 foot underground now, because it's been built on and built on and built on. So you're kind of walking where Jesus was, but it's not the actual thing. But because actually Capernaum was deserted at AD 1100, actually what you walk into is a city that's been uncovered by archaeologists, and it is literally the street layout that it would have been in the time of Christ. And so actually, when you read the sorts of things that Jesus did in Capernaum, it makes absolute sense to you, because you can kind of see it, you're walking around it. Capernaum was first discovered by archaeologists about in the 1800s, or rediscovered, should I say. And at the time, everyone thought it was quite a small town. And now they keep discovering more and more of it. So kind of the estimate used to be that about 1,500 people lived there. Now they're saying, actually, potentially at the time of Christ, possibly 5,000 people lived in Capernaum. So it was quite a large town. I just loved the way, when you walked around it, you could so easily visualize Jesus walking around it. You know, at the heart of Capernaum is the synagogue. It isn't the synagogue that Jesus would have spoken in, but because it's about 400 years after. It was built after that. But it's kind of where the synagogue would have been built. It's been built over the previous one. And you can see that's where Jesus would have taught in the synagogue. And you kind of, if you read the beginning of Mark's gospel, you'd see that he did that. And after he did that, it talks about him going back to Simon Peter's home, Simon Peter's mother-in-law being ill. And to get his Sunday lunch, he has to heal Simon Peter's mother-in-law. And so you kind of stand on the steps of the synagogue, and you kind of look across kind of what are basically walls up to about this height, which is kind of what's been revealed or what's left of the dwellings. And you can see the layout going away from you. And it's like kind of, I guess, how would I best describe it? It's a bit like a kind of classic northern working class community of two up, two down properties, all crammed into quite a small area. So you've got passageways running between very small dwellings, making their way across this area. But where you stand, you look across, and there is a stonking great church built in the middle of it, modern church, and it's got a glass floor. And it's got a glass floor because underneath it is the remains of what is a very ancient church. And what is believed is that ancient church was originally the site of Peter's home, where Jesus went for lunch after going to the synagogue, and in time became a place of worship for kind of early believers. And so you can look from the steps, you can see the journey that they would have made from the synagogue back to Peter's house. And if you kind of go left from there, you kind of walk down to the water's edge and the lake, where they would have, you know, conducted the fishing, where the nets would have been mended, where they would have, where Jesus would have taught, you know, talked to people. Remember how he went out and stood in Peter's boat and preached, used it as a mobile pulpit. You know, it's just so easy to kind of see in front of your very eyes kind of what it would be like. One of the big surprises for me, though, was just how prosperous it was there at Capernaum. Most of what you're looking at is a bit dull. It's kind of grey stonework, and it's quite kind of volcanic-looking rock. And that's kind of what most of the housing was made out of. But there is an incredible amount of marble that has been carved into kind of pillar tops and kind of bits of decorative stuff to stick in people's homes. And the one thing that's really apparent is there's just nowhere local to get marble. Yeah, if you've got to have marble in your home in Capernaum, it means that you've got, it's kind of the equivalent of having a Porsche, basically. Yeah, it's how you kind of show that you are successful and powerful where you have marble built into your home. And many, many of the homes have marble in them. And the marble had been brought for miles. And it was a sign of wealth and power. It's purely ornamental. It's a statement of wealth. And that's because we kind of think of Capernaum as being about fishing. But Capernaum was also on the trade routes that kind of ran from kind of Assyria on one side right the way through to Egypt. And kind of, you know, the wealth of Capernaum came through trade. And the power of Capernaum came through that. And so what you see is a town that has a huge gulf between those who have and kind of, and it's ostentatious because they've got the marble slabs on their homes, and those that work for a pittance, catching fish on the lake in pretty much the same way as people do today. And so into that comes this centurion. Kind of, again, you know, you don't have to be a biblical scholar to know what a centurion is. Most of us kind of dressed up as Roman soldiers at primary school, or our kids did if we're older, or if you're teachers, I'm sure you have days in the year when they all come in dressed up as Romans and all the rest of it. Yeah? Nodding? Thank you, Katie. At least my kids did, they when they went to St. Matthew's anyway. Never mind, you know. We used to have this guy come in who used to, do you remember this guy? He used to come in dressed as a centurion. Pardon? Yeah, they do it every year. This bloke who is, I think he's into a historical reenactment. You know? Well, I'm about to say a saddo, and that's on the tape, isn't it? Oops. Well, come on. It is a bit weird dressing up as a Roman soldier and walking around in Britain, isn't it? Or am I not thinking, am I strange for thinking, okay, behave yourself, Christopher. Don't say things that could potentially be offensive on the tape. Okay. Kind of, we're familiar with this whole thing about centurions. You know, we know that they're a senior kind of Roman soldier that has kind of control over 100 soldiers. It means that a centurion would definitely be one of the haves. He would have had privilege simply by being a soldier in an occupying country. He could make people carry his baggage for him. He would have power over the people around him. But he's still an outsider. He's still a Gentile. Despite his position, he's still on the outside. And what we see here is that having privilege doesn't give anyone an exemption from suffering. Suffering's no respecter of position or power. His servant is sick, and he's concerned about that servant. And that in itself is interesting. It speaks highly of him, doesn't it? You know, I wonder how many Roman centurions would have given a toss if their servant was ill, because servants would have been to a penny. Life would have been cheap. You know, slaves would be bought and sold, and part of that would be the risk that some of them get ill and die on you. What you probably wouldn't do is waste time on them if that was the case. But he does waste time. He clearly cared. We're given little information about the servant except that he is suffering and is paralyzed. We don't know whether it's because of illness or an accident. We're not told. But clearly, the centurion is desperate. And he cares about his servant. And so he comes to Jesus. And Jesus straight away offers to come to his home. And it's just another one of those occasions when Jesus shows himself to be more concerned with people than the Jewish regulations and the rules. Although the servant sees although the centurion sees the problem, Jesus was still willing to go to the centurion's home. And it just seems to me for Jesus, the greater law is always the law of love. That always matters more than regulations. And, you know, I just think we would do well to remember that today, kind of at times with some of the debates that go on when Christianity is trying to defend some sort of moral position. It seems to me that it frequently comes across as lacking in love and grace. And actually, Jesus is always more concerned with people than with rules. This is one of just kind of two occasions when Jesus heals someone from a distance. The other is the healing of an official's son, and that took place in Cana, and you can read about that in John's Gospel. Kind of Luke records this story as well, and he kind of adds a little bit extra to it, a little bit more information. It seems clear that the centurion is well regarded because they're Jewish people that have come along to speak on his behalf. But Jesus just wants to heal. It's the centurion that says, no, you don't need to come to my home. And it seems that he brings his experience of his life and of being a Roman soldier to bear in what he asks of Jesus. Somehow the centurion recognizes the authority that Jesus has. And he talks about being a man under authority himself. You know, as a centurion, he knows that he must obey the person that commands him. To disobey his commanding officer would be absolutely unthinkable. And he expects the same of those that serve him. That if he says a command, it will be acted on. And in the Roman army, to not obey a command, you'd be losing your life for it. It wouldn't be something that you would get away with easily or take lightly. So he brings to bear his knowledge of what it means to exercise authority and to be under authority when he looks up at Jesus and says, "No, I'm a man under authority. Just say it, and it will be done." And Jesus is astonished at this response. You know, that's where kind of the theme that John gave me, the faith of the centurion, kind of comes in. Jesus says, I've never seen faith like this in Israel. And just as I do most of the time when John gives me a subject, I then go on to ignore what he said. I'm not sure of whether actually the faith is the main point that's being made here. It seems to me that the that what we see here is all about authority. The centurion is recognizing the authority that Jesus has. At the end of Jesus' ministry, when he commissions the 12 to carry on his ministry, the Great Commission, he says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Jesus is aware of the authority he has. And it's out of that authority that he kind of sends out his disciples. He does it kind of in his ministry. It talks about him sending out the 12 and the 72 and giving them authority. When we talk about faith, it seems to me sometimes we get far, far too hooked up on what we may feel we have or not have, and we miss the point that actually the whole point of faith is not actually the faith itself, but the one that it's vested in. It's not faith that changes things, but it's God that changes things. And I've heard too many times when people kind of have not seen things happen in their lives, and somehow kind of people have made the suggestion, oh, it's because you don't have enough faith. If you have more faith, you would see it happen. And actually, I think that that's a pretty horrendous thing to say to someone. That what that does is actually make someone an outsider. It says that you don't belong because you haven't got enough faith. The key, it seems to me, which we see here in this whole thing about authority, isn't about the faith itself, but the one in whom it's vested in. And the centurion has got it that actually Jesus has the power to make a difference, that Jesus has authority to make a difference. The best example I can think of is a policeman who if he steps off the pavement and into the road and puts his hands up, on the whole, doesn't get run over. The cars stop for him. Why do they stop? Do they stop because he's kind of like the Incredible Hulk? And if they don't stop, he's going to shove his hand on the bonnet, warp it out of all kind of shape and throw it up in the air? No, they don't stop because he's got the power and the strength to do that. They stop because of the authority that's vested in him. When he steps into the road and puts his hand up, he does it with everything that stands behind him. He has authority vested in him by the government, by the monarch, and you know that if you knock a policeman over, they're going to be coming for you because that authority is vested in him. And it's no different for us. What the centurion recognizes is the authority that's in Jesus. And he says, I'm a man under authority. I know what it means to be under authority and to exercise authority. When I say something, it happens. And he sees that in Jesus. It's not about the faith. It's about recognizing the one that has the power to make a difference. And what is remarkable is that just as the centurion recognizes that and sees that authority and kind of speaks this whole thing about being a man under authority, in a way he's also describing not just Jesus, but also what it's like for us. Because we sit under Jesus' authority, we have that same authority. He's given his authority to us to do the things that he did, to pray, and to expect God to act. And I guess what I'm saying today is, we need to get a fresh vision, both of who Jesus is and the authority he has, because it's all about him, not about our faith. And we also, in the light of who he is, need to have a fresh vision for what it means to us to be his disciples. That just as he said, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, now go and make disciples and teach people to obey what I've taught you. He says the same to us. You know, that authority has been given to me, now I'm telling you, you're under my authority, now you go, and you go in the same authority that I have. And it's a realization of who we trust in that has the potential to make the difference in our lives. Let's pray. Lord, we marvel at what we see when you walk into Capernaum. You speak the words, and a centurion's servant is healed. Lord, just help us to see you through the eyes of that centurion, to see the authority you have and also the authority that you give us. Thank you that the centurion could say, I'm a man under authority. And Lord, there's a sense that we are men and women under authority. You've called us to go in your name and in your authority. Just show us what that means. Amen.